Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here, back with the next installment of our Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today's conversation will focus on the quickly evolving landscape of artificial intelligence and how this technology is continuing to have an impact. Joining us for today's conversation, glad to welcome from our partners at BlackRock, Tony Kim. Tony is a managing director and serves as head of the global technology team within the fundamental equities division of BlackRock's portfolio management group. Tony joined BlackRock in 2013 and has 30 years of experience in technology investments. With that, Tony, thank you for dropping by UBS Market Moves. Nice to have you with us and appreciate you taking some time today to be with our listeners and our clients.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
So, Tony, to begin, can you walk our listeners, our clients, through the AI stack and maybe speak a bit to where you're finding the most compelling opportunities at the moment?
I often speak the best way to interrogate AI is to think of it as a stack, three big layers cake. The bottom is what I call the infrastructure layer of this cake. And within infrastructure, there are, I'd say, three main components. There's the power, and then it's necessary to power the chips. There's the compute, which are all the chips, the silicon that are generating these AI models. And then there's the data centers or the cloud that basically house all the chips and the power, and then run these big hyperscale clusters. So this bottom layer, is the infrastructure layer. This is actually right now currently the biggest part of the AI stack. This is where most of the investment CapEx dollars go, and a good part of the market cap is here at this part of the stack, and this is growing quite quickly. The second layer is where the intelligence is built. These AI factories create the models, or the intelligence layer. This is a new layer. Obviously, before AI, it didn't exist, but now it is becoming arguably the centerpiece of this whole AI stack, where the intelligence sits. And these are the big foundation models, the big AI labs building these models. And so that's the second layer, this intelligence layer. And then at up top, there's what I call the application and services layer. These are the software that knowledge workers all around the world use to do their work. And then there's the labor themselves, all the various labor and services to perform, here this is the vast majority of the economy sits in this service layer. So that's the third layer, the top layer, and what AI has done is kind of shifted the balance of power between these three layers, and you're seeing that in the stock market. What has happened is, as we build more and more capable intelligence, these models, that has grown in prominence. But to grow these models, to build these models, to train and to run the model for inference, we needed to build and continue to build significant infrastructure layer. And so these two layers are where the most of the opportunity are. They're in the power, they're in the compute, they're in the data centers, and they're in the model that are basically building these AI factories that generates the creation of these this AI intelligence. That has, however, seemingly come at the expense of the service and application layer. And this is where you've seen a lot of impact in the software world, And the beginnings impact on services, potentially labor going forward. And there's, as we've seen so far this year, trillions of dollars of market cap basically come out of services and applications, and trillions of dollars of market cap being added to this model and this infrastructure layer. And so as we sit today, we've had 3 years of AI, we're now in the fourth year. These trends will continue, and compute is scarce. There is still a shortage. There is a scarcity across this whole bottom layer of the stack. As the models get bigger and bigger and more capable, the value, you could say the value, which I'll use that term broadly, is being moved from that service application layer down into this model layer. And for the model layer to continue to function, it needs more and more compute, that infrastructure layer. So this is where we see most of the opportunity. This is how we've changed the positioning according to this AI stack. And then I would say going forward, we are also at the very early stages of a, let's call it a fourth new layer. We could say that sits on top of the service application layer. And that's the physical AI, or the physical embodiment of that intelligence that's being created in the model layer. And this will show up, in all forms of devices, machines. It'll be robotics, it'll be drones, it'll be self-driving cars, it'll be satellites and rocket systems, it'll be humanoids. And so that embodiment of that intelligence that's being created will show up in the physical. And this is also coming at the expense, probably, of the service and application layer, as physical tasks, maybe even jobs that are being performed by that service layer, will be embodied in these new physical AI systems. And many of the applications as well will be subsumed there. So I think what we're seeing going forward is the continuation of this trend toward the compute and the intelligence layer, and then the beginning dawn of the physical AI world. So we've also started to see opportunities at this new physical AI layer.
Okay, so there's a lot there to consider in terms, Tony, of what you've been hearing from the industry. Quite timely you're joining us. I understand that you recently wrapped up a two-week Asia Tech Tour where you met with over 40 companies across the AI stack. I'm curious as to what stood out to you the most from those conversations.
Exactly. I just got back just a few days ago, actually. 2 weeks in Asia. Over 40 companies, the three countries I visited were Taiwan, Korea, and Japan. And I think, for many of the listeners here, it's not as obvious why I would spend, multiple weeks there. But, I say about countries, and this even extends into to sovereignty, AI sovereignty, is that every country has its own fingerprints, if you will. We all have unique fingerprints. Every country has unique capabilities. These three in particular are very strong in that bottom layer of AI, that infrastructure layer, if you will. Taiwan, as we all know, is they're experts in the foundry, TSMC, as we know, and the manufacturing of chips, but also they have a whole plethora of companies that are in the hardware supply chain. In particular, some really fascinating areas are in the thermal management, the AI data center cooling and power management, as that bottom layer. These data centers are getting so big, generating so much heat, requiring so much energy. So there are many companies there in Taiwan that are critically important to that supply chain. And I would say, you know, if I were to summarize Taiwan, both on the this thermal power management side, as well as the companies, you know, in the foundry and the chip making, everything is short. Everything is constrained. There are 2-3 year lead times. The projects are fully sold out. Demand is far outstripping supply. And, you know, you're in a situation here that we're looking well into second half of 27, even into 28. And a lot of the conversations are about getting supply capacity online because the surging demand from the supply chain. So that's Taiwan. Secondly, Korea. Korea's fingerprints are, obviously, they are the world's leaders in memory. They have some of the biggest chip makers in the world, Samsung and Hynix, that are two of the three biggest companies in the world around the production of semiconductors for memory chips. But Korea also has companies involved in robotics and automotive, and you're seeing this convergence between EV car production and robotics production, and also in nuclear, again, providing, they're exporting some of the key technology for building nuclear reactors. And so when you look at that, again, that's at that bottom layer of the stack. And a similar message to Taiwan. Chip fabs, to build a memory fab takes several years. 3 years to build, you have to build the building, which takes over 18 months. Then you have to put tens of billions of dollars of fab equipment in. And then by the time if you started today, you're not producing silicon wafers for 3 years later. And so these are constraints. And so there are multiple years of constraints. There's, as we all know, well-documented, huge shortages in memory, because all of these AI models require more and more memory, storage, the computing power to process these agents. And so Korea is running also on multi-year lead times. Things are sold out. There's not enough capacity. And so the companies are scrambling to build capacity in all of these domains. And, you know, as you know, also nuclear is even longer lead times because it takes that long to build these nuclear reactors, many, many years, even longer than it takes to build a data center or memory. So that is Korea. All of those companies are doing fantastic. And again, this all roots from the fact that AI, the demand is outstripping any ability to supply, especially at this bottom layer. And then finally, Japan. We visited a number of companies in Japan, and Japan's fingerprints are somewhat similar to Korea. They have a leading NAND manufacturing facility. They have some semiconductors. They also are some of the best in the world in making the equipment that goes into these fabs, the etch, the deposition tools, you know, lithography adjacent machines, so that's strong. And the similar trends, the surging demand to build these fabs is leading to demand for not only their memory but also their fab equipment. Japan is also very strong in power. So they have some of the biggest companies in building out the grid. As you know, build out these data centers requires more energy, more grid. And Japan is also very strong in the robotics world, physical AI. And so across the entire spectrum, similar story as we saw in Taiwan and Korea. So I just came back. And so, you know, the main message is everything is constrained, not just memory, everything. From the chip all the way down to the entire supply chain, and all the way down to the power level. It is a world of constraints, and that was the unifying message coming out of Asia.
very helpful to have this unique boots on the ground perspective. You certainly covered a lot of ground in a short span there. I want to look beyond artificial intelligence for a few moments. Curious, Tony, as to how are you framing the opportunity and timing for another emerging tech theme, this being quantum computing?
You know, there are, I'll discuss quantum. I think there's three or four, let's call it next gen technologies coming beyond AI. I would say one is quantum, which is a new kind of compute. Second, I think is, you know, there's a lot of work being done in fusion energy, which is basically trying to bring the energy of the sun, fusion reaction into Earth, because given the power constraints, and then we are at the dawn, I think, of a new space economy, which has obviously ties to AI as well. But I would say those three are, you know, as we go into the latter half of this decade, will become more and more prominent. You know, specifically on quantum computing, what I will say is that by 2030. In my opinion, the next 4 years, 4 to 5 years, we will see the birth, a real utilization of what I call a utility scale quantum computer. And what is a quantum computer? It's just a different kind of computer. You know, today the world is, the last 50 years, 60 years, has been built on what they call classical computing, which is really CPUs and GPUs, right? Intel chips, NVIDIA chips, these kinds of processors, these kinds of parallel compute. And they're great at computing the digital world, zeros and ones. We use it for everything, right? Especially in AI. And we feed it lots of data. It processes data like a CPU serially or processes the data parallelly. We build these AI models that are throwing massive data to come up with insights and answers. Well, a quantum computer, you know, without going into all the physics of it, is a different kind of computer. It will sit next to a CPU, a GPU. It'll be a QPU. And in the data center of the future, we'll have these three computing modalities. And what a QPU will do, or a quantum computer will do, is instead of answering questions of the digital world, it effectively is a computer of the natural world, of nature itself. Simulates the natural world. Instead of feeding it huge sums of data, it's quite the opposite. It's quite smaller data, and it's more about explorations of answers. And it is more infinite compute, small data, large compute that is exponentially different and bigger than the current classical computer. And so it solves a different problem. It helps you solve nature itself, you know, the physical things, chemistry, biology, you know, life sciences, healthcare, drug discovery, material science, problems of physics. This kind of computer won't be used to run AI, won't be used to run your spreadsheet, doesn't run PowerPoints. It will solve these intractable problems of huge computation exploration. But it will sit there. It will create, hopefully generate answers and generate data that we can then use to help even turbocharge the AIs that we're building off of classical computing. So I think of it as the computer of nature versus the computer of the digital domain. It will sit inside or parallel to a data center that we have building these super AGI systems. And it will unlock a new kind of computational domain where we can solve problems that we can't currently solve today. And one of those things that also is coming to the forefront is cryptography and encryption, because one of the byproducts of a very, very, very large quantum computer is that it threatens the existing encryption schemes that we currently use, and that would facilitate the need to change all of those. And this is also very geopolitically sensitive, as we're competing with China as to who can get to quantum these quantum thresholds first. And so that's what I would allude to. Again, these are one of the new avenues beyond AI. I would say it's AI. It's adjacent to and supplements what we're doing with AI, but it is a new kind of compute.
Putting AI to work in the context of investing, how does your team leverage artificial intelligence in the investment process? What does that look like?
So we use it now every day. We internally, for the last 3 years, I've been building our internal agentic research platform called Asimov. I named it after Isaac Asimov, the OG science fiction novelist. So we're building this agentic research system that works in conjunction with our research analysts and portfolio managers, either to fully help supplement, automate much of the tasks of, around writing reports, building, getting analysis, doing valuation works, looking at the totality of information across all of these specialized domains of technology, looking at huge sums of companies and information. And so this is a kind of a default layer of knowledge that works in conjunction with our analysts to supplement their research capabilities. And also, we're working on things to help analyze portfolios, to work in conjunction with portfolio managers, to identify anomalies, things that we're missing in supplementing the research, and have these AI, these agents, not only do the deep help in the deep research, but look at almost as a kind of another advisor and looking at kind of the work that we are doing and looking as another check and eyes on the things that we're working on. So in a way to push forth fundamental research, into a more advanced domain where they work in conjunction with analysts, and the analysts and portfolio managers themselves can even do more in terms of capabilities of the kind of the research that we're doing. So that is a project that I started. It is now live, it's functional, and we're constantly building to enhance the capabilities of that system.
Well, very interesting, Tony, to hear about how AI is being applied on your team. Always intriguing to hear about the application of AI in various contexts. Before we close out, maybe, Tony, if you can wrap by speaking a bit to the AI CapEx cycle, where you see it going in 2026 and how it may differ from 2025, and is power likely to be a constraint in the coming years?
The last question, yes, power is a constraint. The constraints are, multifaceted, as I think I mentioned when I, coming from Asia. There are a lot of constraints everywhere, not just, it's not that we don't have enough energy per se, like the natural gas, which is like the biggest use, the power source. We don't have enough nuclear, but nuclear takes, decades to get online. So you got to shorten the lead times getting nuclear reactors on. Solar, is another, natural gas, of course. These are constraints. And so they will continue to be constrained. I think another constraint is the data centers themselves take two plus years to build. And then you have to, kit them all out with all the gear, all the switching gear, the grid is also totally overloaded and old, and it takes a long time to get the grid connections, and then you have regulatory constraints because people don't want to put these data centers everywhere in your backyard, in your neighborhood, so you gotta get the permitting through, and so then there's resistance sometimes, it takes time to get that through. And so when you go through all of that to build these multi gigawatts that were the tens of gigawatts that will be built every year in the U.S., all of these add up to constraints, not only the power itself, but everything. And again, also remember, 70% of the cost of the data center are the chips. And the chips are even, like the leading edge foundry and memory are even more constrained than the power right now. So it is a world of constraints on CapEx. So that's number one. The second, to your point of the CapEx spending, this year will be probably close to $800 billion of CapEx spent, on AI data centers and AI CapEx, in the U.S., probably almost up to $1 trillion globally, much of this CapEx is the big hyperscalers, but there's a new emerging class of what they call neoclouds and new AI data centers. Obviously, emblematic of that are companies like Oracle, CoreWeave, Nebius, Stargate, these kinds of companies that are these new clouds. They're also building sovereign governments like the Middle East, various countries in Europe and Asia are also embarking on building their own sovereign data centers. So that whole cluster of companies is also spending hundreds of billions of dollars on top of the $750-800 billion that are the big hyperscalers are spending. And, obviously this is growing quite quickly. I could see the next very quickly will be passing $1 trillion. If not on a path to over $1.5 trillion in the next few years. And this is being funded by their EBITDA, or their free cash flow. And so, what seems to be happening is these companies are willing to spend up to their free cash flow, all their cash flow on the CapEx. So they generate, free cash flow zero. And in some cases, free cash flow even goes negative as they're building out these AI CapEx AI factories. And the reason they're doing this is because, A, they believe in the revenue that is coming in. These token factories generate significant revenue. That is, hopefully will lead to accelerating revenue growth for these companies. Is it worth the effort to put in all of this capital spending? And I think the universal answer is yes. It's both. They're seeing the revenue come in, and it's coming in at unprecedented rates. We always talk about the CapEx, but we fail to realize how fast these AI companies and AI revenue is coming in. These token factories become a new factory, effectively, generating tokens, and the tokens are revenue. And so this is why this investment continues. I see no abatement in 26. And in fact, again, coming back from my supply chain meetings in Asia, they see this going into 27 and even into the discussions now are procuring capacity, which is forward CapEx, into 28 and 29. And so we got multiple years more of this coming. So I think it's on the CapEx front, the last 3 years and the next 3 years might look consistent. This continued inexorable push to keep building more AI computing capacity.
Well, Tony, you've been very generous with your time today, very productive, insightful conversation, and the conversation, of course, will continue as we monitor the evolution of this exciting technology. It would be great to have you back at some point, Tony, though thank you again for dropping by UBS On Air Market Moves and for spending some time with their listeners and their clients. Appreciate it.
No, thank you so much. UBS has been a great partner, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Financial Services, Inc. does not provide legal or tax advice, and this does not constitute such advice. UBS strongly recommends that persons obtain appropriate independent legal, tax, and other professional advice. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.